Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Claycock in Bonn. This week on Inside Europe, witnessing war crimes, we mark the 30th anniversary of the Srebrenica massacre, the first legally recognised genocide in Europe since the end of the Second World War. Then, moral compass. What are the responsibilities of journalism in the face of Israeli war crimes in Gaza? We speak to Hanno Hauenstein, a German journalist drawing very different conclusions to the majority of his peers. A programme of difficult topics and urgent questions. That's here on Inside Europe. Now, it's not often that I begin the programme with a content warning, but this is one of those exceptions. This programme is about war crimes and the responsibilities of witnessing. It may be difficult listening in places. Last week, tens of thousands of people in Bosnia and Herzegovina marked the 30th anniversary of the genocide at Srebrenica. But it wouldn't be accurate to say that the whole country marked the day, because deep divisions remain. Many Bosnian Serb leaders deny that the systematic murder of more than 8,000 people at Srebrenica constituted genocide, and that's despite the international court verdicts which convicted the wartime Bosnian Serb leaders Ratko Mladic and Radovan Karadzic. As our correspondent Guy Delaunay reports from Bosnia, this inability to agree on the past is clouding the country's present and its future.
There's a real buzz here in the foyer of Sarajevo's War Theatre, where people are getting ready to go in and see the world premiere of a performance called The Flowers of Srebrenica.
This is Srebrenica.
The play reflects the grim reality of the events, not just of July 1995, but the ensuing decades of unresolved grief and divisions in Bosnia and Herzegovina.
1995.
Bosnian Serb forces systematically murdered more than 8,000 people at Srebrenica. It remains the single worst atrocity committed in Europe since the Second World War, and international courts have ruled it was an act of genocide against the Bosniak population, who are mostly Muslim. But many Bosnian Serb leaders deny that, adding anger and frustration to the enduring grief.
I thought when 30 years passed that we are going to come to our senses, not us here that we know what's going on, but those who deny genocide and who are all those spin doctors who are manipulating facts.
Selma Alispahic is the lead actress of the Sarajevo War Theatre and a former refugee from Bosnia's conflict.
People sometimes get tired of having to prove the truth that has been proven so many times, you know, even in international court.
Genocide denial is just a symptom of Bosnia's other divisions. The Dayton Peace Agreement ended the war in 1995, but it divided the country on ethnic grounds. Most Bosniaks and Croats live in the Federation, while the majority of Serbs are in Republika Srpska. There's a state-level government, but it's weak. That's been exploited by Republika Srpska's president, Milorad Dodik. He's been pushing to withdraw from national institutions, including the judiciary. There's also been legislation to establish a reserve police force, a term once used for murderous Serb militia during Bosnia's conflict.
This is dangerous, playing both the memory of those who have experienced the 1990s.
Christian Schmidt is the ultimate power in Bosnia, the international high representative. He's at loggerheads with Republika Srpska's leadership.
I see the unresponsible part of the political class just playing with this. And this needs as well a clear presence of the international community on military level, just in the sheer presence of promising the people that they were kept and supported in a peaceful manner.
Hundreds of people are standing under umbrellas in the rain here in front of the presidency building in Sarajevo, and they're paying their respects to a convoy of vehicles which is taking the remains of recently identified victims of the Srebrenica massacre to Potocari Cemetery for burial.
But just 15 minutes up the road, in East Sarajevo, there are no public references to the massacre. That's because it's part of Republika Srpska, where there's little enthusiasm for the Srebrenica commemorations.
In this country, Bosniaks, Croats and Serbs were killed, and crimes were committed on all three sides.
Staša Košarac is a leading member of Milorad Dodik's SNSD party and also serves as foreign trade minister in the state government.
One structure in this country, predominantly Bosniaks, are insisting only talking about victims on the Bosniak side. A crime has been committed in Srebrenica, no Serbs deny that, but we have the right to point out the crimes against Serbs in and around Srebrenica.
They may admit there's been a crime, but many Bosnian Serb leaders deny that crime was genocide. That's despite multiple verdicts at the International Tribunal in The Hague. Bosnian Serb military leader Ratko Mladic and political leader Radovan Karadzic are both serving life sentences for orchestrating genocide at Srebrenica. That denial is baffling for the man who prosecuted them, Serge Bramertz.
Perhaps today they think, well, we are getting away with it because the world has very much changed. Is it because people have no real project for their communities, no economic or societal project in the region, and are trying that to continue winning elections by being nationalists, by speaking more about the differences to others than about what they have in common with other communities? It's really difficult to understand.
It's a solemn moment here at Potocari Cemetery. The funerals of seven victims of the genocide at Srebrenica are being held.
It has deep meaning to me and my family and all the survivors.
Mirela Osmanović was born 2 years after her two older brothers were murdered at Srebrenica. She and the surviving members of the family still live in the town today.
Srebrenica, as such, is a very specific place to live. People here are living with potential perpetrators. People here are living with genocide deniers, with those who glorified war criminals, and yet they are living at their homes because this is their home, and they don't want to go anywhere because they don't need to go. This is where they belong.
That may be some comfort, but after 30 years, true reconciliation clearly remains elusive, and that's a problem for all the people in Bosnia and Herzegovina, whatever their ethnicity. Guy Delaunay, DW, Srebrenica.
At a panel discussion during Deutsche Welle's recent Global Media Forum, an audience member got up and strolled purposefully towards an empty chair on the stage. This was her intervention.
I was a journalist in the region during the Balkan Wars. And even though I worked for public broadcaster Serbia, which was propagandist media, and lost my job and had all the problems with the police, beaten, arrested, hospital.
Let's stay at the point here.
It genocide, what was happening in Srebrenica.
The panel that Serbian journalist decided to address was on Gaza. And her argument was this. Journalism, she said, is about speaking truth to power. In 1995, she and her colleagues called the Srebrenica massacre a genocide, and today, based on the evidence of their own eyes and the confirmation of reputable human rights organisations such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, she believes that journalists should be using the same language to describe Israel's systematic killing of civilians in the Gaza Strip. This argument is highly emotionally charged, particularly in Germany. The mainstream German media position on the panel was represented by Dr. Rainer Esser, CEO of Die Zeit newspaper. Genocide, he argued, is a legal term. It should not be used until a court has delivered legal clarity. In addition, he claimed, in the case of Gaza, it's difficult to adjudicate on facts because there are no reliable on-the-ground sources. We'll come to that claim later. The outlier position on the panel was represented by the German freelance journalist Hanno Hauenstein, who began using the term in his work about a year ago and who has written and spoken publicly about his decision since. We'll be talking to him after the break. That's here on Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock in Bonn. Hanno Hauenstein occupies a fairly unusual space in the German media landscape. Non-Jewish, but Hebrew-speaking, he is the co-founder of a German-Hebrew cultural magazine called Aviv, as well as the author of freelance articles for publications including Haaretz, The Guardian and The Intercept. His journalistic involvement with Israel goes back some 15 years. And, as he explained to me, from the beginning, his interest in the country was connected to his identity as a German.
I'm German. I'm not Jewish. I grew up in Germany with similar narratives as did other people around Israel-Palestine and what that part of the world means for German history, how it's intertwined, and like what kind of sort of lessons we draw from being a nation of perpetrators. I was just curious, you know, I was kind of in this gap year in between my bachelor and my master's studies when I was in my early 20s that I went to Israel as like a research assistant in Tel Aviv University. I also started doing journalism at the time, so I kind of like got into that place with some preconceived notion of what its politics are. And I started fairly early to associate myself with Israeli journalists and over time, increasingly more also Palestinian journalists, and just like learned more about the society, about the kind of the lived reality of the place. And that's kind of, I feel like I deconstructed a lot of the sort of like fantasies that I had about the place. A lot of Germans kind of grow up with this idea of Israel as like a happy ending to sort of their own identity, as it's like, you know, like this, the atrocities of the Holocaust are obviously intertwined with the existence of the state of Israel. And in a way, there's this kind of like idealized notion that this is just like a place that we have to cherish and keep, you know, in high regard. That is often very detached from the reality on the ground.
Okay. And that context, I think, is so helpful for understanding the moment in which we're speaking now. We are looking at a situation where we have a big divergence between the way in which the conflict in Gaza is being reported on in Germany and the way in which it is being reported on in other international sort of media spheres. And you have been a voice who has stood out because there was a big difference in the language, for example, that you are using to describe what Israel is doing in Gaza, and the language that most of the rest of the German media landscape is using. And one of the key differences is that you have decided consciously, and this is something that you've written about, to use the word genocide. Can you tell me about that decision?
I have hesitated with using that term for quite some time because I do draw a distinction between my role as a journalist and broadly what people see or define as activism. Like, I don't see myself as an activist, and like I also I'm not a lawyer. But why I decided around a year ago or so like to use the term actively in my vocabulary as a journalist and as a speaker in public events is, I mean, A, because I feel it's accurate, you know, from everything I know, like It's not only a legal term, it's also a term that's going back to Raphael Lemkin, and it carries an intellectual legacy, and like it conveys something that is beyond, you know, the legal definition that was later adopted by the UN. We know as journalists that like language shapes reality. And in order to push for a kind of like a moral reckoning or a legal reckoning or like just a political change, I think that we have a responsibility as journalists to be committed to the facts. And like, if you look at the facts on the ground in Gaza today, if you look at the systematic destruction of almost the entire Gaza Strip, of universities, of schools, of hospitals, of broad infrastructure, if you look at the targeted assassination of health workers and journalists, it's very difficult for me to defend a kind of notion of neutrality where I still sort of put this word in parentheses. So I'm trying to also push back towards what I regard as a tendency of like an incredible amount of credulity among colleagues in Western media outlets, not only in Germany, but specifically in Germany, credulity towards state narratives, where like we see like a huge imbalance for, first of all, what sources are getting quoted and referred to as credible and what aren't quoted or overlooked. That's one. But also just like, you know, the way in which Israeli state narratives and German state narratives are copy-pasted, I think consciously and unconsciously often, like into articles, into specifically news media, a general tendency which I want to put my finger on and like basically also create like a counterbalance too.
Yeah, that question of whose voices are heard is a really, really important one. And there was a very telling moment in the panel, and I don't want to pick on Dr. Rainer Esser here, but, you know, he was reflecting, I think, an attitude that you hear a lot, and that was that, you know, well, it's very difficult to prove anything because there are no journalists in Gaza. And, of course, there are journalists in Gaza, but they're Palestinian journalists.
Palestinian voices are marginalized, met with distrust, disbelief, suspicion. When I look at the past 2 years, the amount of articles that are just like firsthand reports from journalists in Gaza are very limited. That the ones that we have seen, we've seen published in Germany, and like, you know, it's not hard to get in touch with those people. I'm in touch with many people on the ground in Gaza through social media, through Instagram, through other channels, through WhatsApp. It's actually fairly easy to get like one-on-one first-hand reporting, even by freelancers, even by people. One can understand that there is a certain hesitation within German newsrooms towards journalists that might be in one way or another affiliated to Hamas, right? I mean, the Hamas close outlets exist in Gaza, but nevertheless, there are other voices as well. And it's just like the fact that like we have over 200 colleagues targeted and killed in Gaza, and we still uphold this idea that there are no credible voices on the ground is quite strange to me.
Hanno, one thing that both panelists, in fact, I think, said to you at various points during the discussion in Bonn was that they perceived you as involving emotion in your reporting. I thought that was very interesting. Is your understanding of your reporting that it's coming from a place of emotion?
I was like, this is how women must feel 90% of the time in every society. It's like, this was an aha moment for me. Well, yes, obviously it's an emotional subject. I think everything is emotional to some degree. If you're serious about your journalism, you can't fully detach yourself from being emotional. And if sources on the ground that you're in touch with are suddenly, you know, I've been talking, for example, to Hossam Shabbat, a journalist who was targeted and killed by the military earlier this year. I talked to him in October of last year, like via Instagram, and like we had a short phone call. And like, you know, like if you experience such things and then you see that person is suddenly dead, of course you cannot not be somewhat emotional. But like, I don't think that I ground my journalism necessarily only in emotions. I do ground it in fact-checking and in the core principles of journalism, of accurate research, and of like trying to really tell the way things are. But I don't think our role as journalists is to sort of stabilize existing power relations. My ideal version of journalism is to hold power to account, to ask critical questions, and to also call into question this idea of like default neutrality that ends up stabilizing the kind of like system we live in today. And like when journalism ends up amplifying narratives that normalize or even legitimize, you know, mass killing on like this, on the scale we've seen in Gaza, I think there is something severely going wrong. And we need to have a real discussion over what this actually, what the role of journalists really is.
That's so interesting, because I mean, what I think you've just done there for me is set out a sort of a personal ethics of journalism, right? You know, that the moral compass that keeps you honest as a reporter. And I suppose my question is about whether you think that there's sort of been a conflict between that and an ethical compass that many people who were socialized in Germany, socialized as German, carry in relation to their sort of national identity and their responsibilities towards that aspect of their identity.
You're asking whether there's a conflict in between that like national identity and like and the kind of aspirational goal of like...
Yeah, I mean, sorry, I suppose it's crappy to get you to talk for other people, but I mean, for you personally, you know, has there ever been a moment when you've thought the ethical code that I am following as a journalist that is guiding me in what I say, in the language that I use, has there ever been a moment for you when that has come into conflict with an ethical compass that you carry as someone who grew up German, socialized as German, very, very conscious of memory culture and of the sort of historical responsibilities that Germans grow up with from a very, very early age in relation to their past?
Historical responsibility is something at the core of my work. I think that's incredibly important. I think that it's that Germans feel a special kind of relationship towards Israel is something that is very understandable. I don't think that's necessarily, you know, per se bad, but I think it should come with it. That responsibility should come with, you know, feeling responsible for knowing things about the place, for knowing things about its history, for knowing things about like the people that have been dispossessed by the creation of that state and like continue to be dispossessed today as we speak. I mean, like what's happening in Gaza is not only a genocide, it's in the eyes of Palestinians also a continuation of the Nakba, which is like really at the heart of the creation of the state of Israel today. So I think like we need to think of like what that historical responsibility means. And to me, the notion that it means that we can legitimize or normalize or quote unquote neutralize the killing of tens of thousands of people in Gaza today, that's frankly absurd. I mean, like, it's not something that should be center of long discussions. It should be like intuitive and very easy to understand.
Hanno Hauenstein, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you so much for having me. That was a big honor to be on.
The German freelance journalist Hanno Hauenstein there. Germany is currently the second biggest supplier of weapons to Israel next to the US and is the subject of a complaint brought by Nicaragua at the ICJ accusing it of complicity in genocide. Both Germany and Israel strongly deny the claims. Our exploration of the responsibilities of witnessing continues in the second half of the programme when I will be talking to Wayne Jordash Casey, a leading human rights lawyer documenting Russian war crimes in Ukraine. That's here on Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock in Germany.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. We begin with an interview with Wayne Jordache KC, founder and president of Global Rights Compliance, an international human rights foundation currently supporting Ukraine's Office of the Prosecutor General to document and prosecute Russian war crimes. The KC in Wayne's title, by the way, stands for King's Council. That's supposedly a mark of excellence, singling out the creme de la creme of Britain's legal elite. Now, the supposedly in that description, it's not mine, it's Wayne's. And I'm telling you that because I think that in order to understand the unexpected direction that this interview took, there is one thing that you need to know about Wayne Jordache KC. And that is that despite, or perhaps precisely because of, his high-flying legal career, he feels that his perspective is still very much that of the outsider.
I come from a very working-class community in the northeast of England. I was brought up by adopted parents, and suddenly I found myself amongst the great and good, the king's councils of this world, the judges of this world, the politicians of this world. But I understand what it is like to come from an ordinary community. And so I remain very much connected to that root.
When Russia invaded Ukraine on the 24th of February 2022, Wayne Jordache was already on the ground. Global Rights Compliance had been documenting war crimes in Russian-occupied eastern regions and Crimea since 2015. They knew the patterns. They knew what to expect. And so, whilst others were offering remote lectures and training, Global Rights Compliance set about establishing mobile justice teams to help gather evidence on the ground. And if I tell you the names of these teams, you will get an inkling of the patterns that they were anticipating. There's a team for conflict-related sexual violence, a mobile child justice team, a team dealing with starvation and attacks on critical infrastructure, and an environmental crimes team, as well as four regional teams working with prosecutors gathering evidence close to the front lines.
What Russia's trying to do is to control Ukraine, subjugate its people, and extinguish Ukrainian identity. And there can be no dispute about this. Putin has made it very clear that that's what his objectives are. He doesn't believe that Ukraine is a real country. He believes that it's part of Russia, and it's crystal clear that this is what his Russian military are trying to do. So when they occupy a particular territory, they lock the territory down, they set up prison detention centres, they disappear into those prison detention centres anyone who could militarily oppose the occupation, or whoever could organize any armed resistance or any civilian resistance. And so into those detention centers go those people who are tortured, lots of sexual violence. 70-80% of those who've been in detention under the Russian military command or FSB command are sexually violated. And once those people are in detention, then the rest of the population is open for more abuse and for a system of persecution whereby they are forced essentially to give up their Ukrainian identity. Well, what does that mean? That means you remove all Ukrainian names from streets, you change the educational curriculum, you indoctrinate the children that's in the schools, you force Ukraine to be taught as a non-sovereign entity, you insist and you force the Ukrainians to take Russian passports, or else they won't be able to get benefits, they won't be able to get their pensions, etc. And then you also, with the men of fighting age, you conscript them into the Russian army to fight against the Ukrainian military. So you can see it's a system of persecution which is ultimately designed to achieve one aim, which is to disappear Ukraine.
The Council of Europe announced recently the establishment of a tribunal for the crime of aggression. What does that add?
When the full-scale invasion happened and the discussion about a tribunal began, I was very sceptical for a number of reasons. One, you know, I grew up in the International Criminal Tribunal, so I understand the the virtues of them, and I understand how they can be a problem. And, you know, some of those problems include being expensive. Some of those problems include being very slow. Some of those problems are they're very distant from the affected communities, from the victims, because they're often held outside of the place where the crimes took place. They're also, unfortunately, a bit of an industry for international criminal lawyers. If you want to get wealthy in international criminal law, then you work at a tribunal. You don't work at the national level. And so for those and other reasons, I was very skeptical. I didn't think it would add much to the national prosecutions and to the ICC and to the third country investigations that I just talked about. But over time, you know, I live in Ukraine, so I'm fairly familiar with Ukrainian views and diverse Ukrainian views, and it's hugely supported by Ukrainians. The vast majority want to see a tribunal for the crime of aggression. The reason, I think, for that generally is Ukrainians want recognized the terrible crime that has been done to them above and beyond war crimes, above and beyond crimes against humanity, and above and beyond even genocide. And that was one of the reasons my skepticism was reduced. And then the second reason was, when you look at the crime of aggression, it's a bit of a cliche now, but everyone talks about it being the crime of crimes, where the evil of the whole is contained within, because without the crime of aggression in Ukraine or wherever, you wouldn't have all the war crimes, you wouldn't have the crimes against humanity, and you wouldn't have the genocide. If you don't have it for Ukraine, when do you have it?
So I think what I'm hearing is that, yes, it is the right crime to be looking at. I guess the question then is the Council of Europe the right entity to be establishing a tribunal?
Gosh, that's a very big question, and I'm not sure. I think the proof of the pudding will be in the eating. I think it's a political decision, of course, because ultimately it's in large part because there wasn't the consensus of the General Assembly. That would have been a better place, and it would have been better because then you could have created an international court, and if you could have created an international court, you'd have been able to get around the immunities of the Troika, the President, the Prime Minister, and the Foreign Secretary, Lavrov, from Russia. But there wasn't the consensus. It became regional. And the Council of Europe is as good an entity as any when it comes to a European project.
So what sort of concrete measures and mechanisms would you want to be seeing inbuilt, baked in from the beginning, to ensure that this is indeed effective?
Let me start by saying what just drilling down a bit when it comes to international tribunals and what they can do and what they often don't do. So they can, I think, deliver a measure of justice when other options are not available. Unfortunately, then what often happens is the system that's created, the statute, the rules of procedure, foreshadow an overly lengthy process. Now, some people may say, well, that's necessary to ensure fair trials, but I don't buy that. With the International Criminal Court, one of the reasons the trials take a long time is because the trials are complex, and another reason they take a long time is because if you look at the system that they've implemented, which involves a whole committal process, which is often like a mini trial, before getting to an actual trial, then you begin to understand that even if you tweak at its efficiency, it will still take a very long time. You don't need part of that process. And that's true of many of the international or regional courts. They adopt similar processes which take a long time and often unnecessarily so. So that's the first thing. The second is there are no clear timelines for prosecution. So, you know, you put a bunch of lawyers and administrators who are all making healthy salaries into an institution like that, and guess what? It takes a long time. Thirdly, and this is maybe the most important one, often these institutions they don't attract the best quality of people, in particular the judges. That may sound surprising to those who don't understand international courts, but the number one problem with international courts is the judges. They are nominated usually by member states. They often have very little judicial experience. They often have very little international criminal law experience. And as a consequence, they don't know what they're doing.
I have to admit, I'm really quite shaken, actually, by what I've just heard, because in the context of a historic case, right, where the crimes are in the past, to hear a leading King's Counselor say that, you know, that there is frustration with a system which creates sort of incentives for a professional sort of class of experts to get involved and to get comfortable and to prolong proceedings, that would be one thing. But, you know, we're talking here about crimes that are happening right now as we speak, you know, and you would have thought that the absolute sort of imperative would be to stop that now.
I am constantly shocked at the apathy of the public when it comes to these types of crimes. And I'm also shocked at the apathy of many professionals within my own industry when it comes to trying to investigate and prosecute and deter these crimes. Don't get me wrong, there's a lot of well-intentioned, very highly motivated professionals in my industry as well. And they are the vast majority. However, you know, I think within these international tribunals, I don't think they are the vast majority. I think there is a large contingent, if not a majority, then a large minority whose interests are not to actually come out with results. And there's many reasons why we're in a legitimacy of crisis for international criminal law. And one of those reasons is because of these professionals whose interests are somewhat at odds with the real success of these institutions.
I think where we've sort of ended up really is sort of it's quite existential, right? It's sort of, you know, the role, the purpose, the imperative of witnessing and of justice seeking, because what you're sort of describing is a reality which seems so very far divorced from the on-the-ground work that you and your colleagues, and I imagine also particularly your Ukrainian colleagues, are experiencing in Ukraine and are plugged into. And, you know, the sense of urgency that I can hear from your voice and that, you know, I hear every time that I talk to people in Ukraine.
My wife is Ukrainian. My life in Ukraine has been about, you know, integrating into Ukrainian life to the extent that it's possible, and I'm motivated by my empathy for what is happening to Ukrainians and to Ukraine and the risks to Ukraine. And when I see lawyers and the international professional class fail to understand that, it adds to my frustration and it adds to my anger. I'm invested here emotionally, and I want Ukraine to succeed, and I want that more than I want anything for myself.
Wayne Jordash, KC, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you for the questions that made me think.
If you have any comments or questions about that interview with Wayne Jordash, KC, or any other item featured on the show, then our feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com, and we would love to hear from you. In the meantime, it's time to turn from war to the laying down of arms, in this case, quite literally. Earlier this month, a group of fighters from the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, symbolically disarmed in northern Iraq. The highly publicised event is being heralded as a milestone in peace efforts with the Turkish government, expected to end a nearly five-decade armed conflict which has claimed over 40,000 lives. However, as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, peace is still by no means assured, and if it comes, the price may be steep.
A ceremony in northern Iraq, PKK commander Beseh Hozat announces the disarmament of 30 fighters. She says the 15 men and 15 women are disarming of their own free will, as part of their commitment to a peaceful pursuit of a democratic socialist society. The weapons are then burned.
ilgili çevre ve kamuoyuna açık olarak temin etmeniz.
The imprisoned PKK leader, Abdullah Öcalan, released a video just days before reiterating his call for an end to the group's 41-year armed struggle for Kurdish autonomy. It was the first time people in Turkey had heard his voice since he was jailed 26 years ago.
Unutmayalım, yeni bir gündür. Bugün...
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan declaring to his party supporters that the country had reached an historic moment. Ankara expects a complete disarmament by the thousands of PKK fighters by autumn. Since the start of the peace process last year, Erdogan ruled out any concessions, insisting it was a surrender by the rebels. However, the high-profile ceremony puts pressure on the government to reciprocate, says Asla Aydintashbash of the Brookings Institution in Washington.
It really is a historic moment. This is a conflict that has been going on for almost half a century. Now it's the government's turn to actually open up the political space. Both the Kurdish side and the Turkish side is very focused on telling their own constituency that they're not giving up much, convincing their own constituency, which seems sort of, in both cases, unprepared for this radical shift. But the government has already loosened up conditions on Abdullah Öcalan's imprisonment. He has better conditions, is able to communicate, has a secretary and so on.
The PKK is pressing for an amnesty and a right to return to Turkey for its fighters abroad. There have also been calls for the release of Öcalan, along with tens of thousands of people jailed under Turkey's anti-terror laws. However, Zeynep Arduç, an expert on conflict resolution at Istanbul's Medeniyet University, warns a worrying opaqueness exists around the peace process.
It is really difficult to even assess it because we don't really know what's going on. For instance, some negotiations, they are not going to be public, but at least like the public should be informed. I mean, there should be a bit of transparency because people don't trust state institutions, people don't trust each other, people don't trust the government, I mean, or judiciary. So it is not that easy to, you know, succeed if this is the case, like if this is the context you are conducting this process. The government, they need to reinstill trust in people. I mean, not just Kurdish people, but Turkish people as well.
Following the disarmament ceremony, Erdogan announced the formation of a parliamentary commission comprising his AK party, his coalition partner, the MHP, and the pro-Kurdish DEM party. Notably, the main opposition, CHP, was excluded. Analyst Atilla Yeşilada for Global Source Partners says domestic politics has become part of the process. Put simply, Erdogan needs the support of Kurdish parliamentarians in order to push through constitutional reforms which would end term limits, enabling him to stay in power indefinitely.
I think in a nutshell, Erdogan is trying to juggle two conflicting priorities. A, give Kurds the least of what they want in return for a constitution that would give him eligibility, then he can run again. B, at the same time, broaden its war against CHP. I don't know how he can finesse that.
While Erdogan talks about a new era of Turks, Arabs and Kurds uniting, the president is waging an unprecedented legal crackdown on the main opposition, CHP, even claiming the party poses a terror threat. In the past, the pro-Kurdish DEM party has supported CHP candidates in presidential and mayoral elections. Kurdish analyst Mesut Yen of the Team think tank says Erdogan may have miscalculated if he believes he can use the peace process to divide the opposition.
If Erdogan's pressure on CHP is maintained, then it's likely that DEM party electorates, DEM party people, DEM party cadres could be sort of unhappy because they might easily think that, okay, if Erdogan becomes successful in his campaign against CHP, then afterward he might start a similar campaign targeting the DEM party. So I think they'll try to kind of have a kind of balance.
Powerful forces are continuing to drive the peace process forward. But just what exactly will that peace look like when it comes? and what will be the price? Questions to which, for the moment at least, there are no easy answers. Doreen Jones, DW, Istanbul.
We're circling back to the Balkans region in a minute. Peace, but with a caveat. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Kosovo's political system is experiencing a prolonged period of gridlock at the moment. The parliament's without a speaker, a position sometimes also referred to as parliamentary president. And until politicians can agree on one, the democracy's pretty much on hold. DW Kosovo correspondent Vjosa Cherkini spoke to me earlier this week to explain the situation. But we began the discussion by talking not so much about Kosovo's present as about its past and Vjosa's too. Vjosa was, she told me, still a young child in 1999 when the war in Kosovo came to an end. And her family's story is, in many ways, the story of the country.
I was 5 years old when the war happened in Kosovo. I was just a kid and I had always to move from a part of the country to another part, like moving from the city where I lived with my family and moving from Ferizaj to the mountains and then from the mountains to the center again and then from there to North Macedonia in refugee camp and from there to Germany. And it was definitely not easy during that time. So I was just a kid, but I still have all the memories what happened during that time. But we had even 26 years before, but also now, a huge love for Kosovo. And why my dad and my family decided to come back to Kosovo, it was exactly the love that they had for Kosovo, but also the willingness to rebuild the country.
And I mean, that's also a journey of great hope, right? I mean, when your parents moved back, they were moving back to a country that was poised to declare its independence, which it did unilaterally in 2008. It was a country that was sort of rising from the ashes of war, that was going to, you know, set out on its own path, a hopeful path, a path orientated towards the European Union. And yet, yeah, so here we are and we're talking in 2025 in a context in which Kosovo is experiencing a situation of political gridlock, which has been going on for some time. It's now failed. Is it 43 times to elect a parliamentary president? I mean, things are not really going that well, are they?
In Kosovo right now, we have since four months a blockade in the parliament. So the political deadlock continues. No solution is in sight. So basically, the responsibility for the political institutional deadlock in Kosovo lies with all parties, according to analysts, but also to the situation that we see. We have Ved Vendosje, the party of the Prime Minister Albin Kurti, and that they are basically the winner of the elections. And they are just trying to not change basically the recommendation of the opposition for the candidate of the president of parliament. So basically, we have a clash between the opposition parties and also the Ved Vendosje party or the winner party. The politicians tried 46 times now to elect the president of parliament and they failed because they just don't want to do a compromise. They need to change their behavior in order to not block millions of euros donations that the other countries are giving to Kosovo in order to develop the country. So basically, they block the system.
Right. And in the meantime, of course, Kosovo's hopes of EU candidate status, at the moment it's only got potential candidate status, become ever more distant. And here I think we have to sort of mention what happened in 2023, because in 2023, the EU adopted temporary and reversible measures, which haven't actually turned out to be particularly temporary or reversible. And these are basically sort of sanctions against Kosovo. And this was in response to tensions that happened in northern Kosovo when Kosovo's police cracked down very hard on protests that were happening because of the installation of newly elected mayors in an area with an ethnic Serb population. Is that a fair sort of picture of what happened then?
Exactly. So this sanction, they are valid even now. So basically, there are three major reasons why the whole situation is like this right now. Albin Kurti's hardline domestic policy, especially concerning the Serbian population, like abolishment of Serbian shadow institutions, ban of the Serbian dinar, which is basically their money. Also, everything what you mentioned brought to this situation, and the clashes that were in 2023, they were the worst clashes that we ever had in the north, where even NATO soldiers were basically injured. Now the situation is much better, but for example, Kurti decided last week to build two other bridges over the Ibar River, which brought again, for example, in the north of Kosovo, discussions and also a little bit of a few people from the Serbian minority, they protested against that because they mentioned that Kurti is not asking at all the Serbian community for every decision that he is basically taking in the north. The dialogue with Serbia is not anymore existing, basically. So there are a lot of problems that everybody is talking about them, but nobody's taking any responsibility.
Mm. So we've got a situation of political gridlock, but also fracturing along ethnic lines and sort of, you know, echoes there of the, some of the darkest chapters in the region's history in terms of tensions with, you know, the ethnic Serb population and with Serbia. What is left, Vjosia? Where do you still see that hope that all those years ago brought your family back to Kosovo, that enabled them to believe in Kosovo as an idea and as a project?
Hope is there because we have youngsters that are very dedicated and very well prepared. The hope of young people, the will to change the country and also to ask basically the politicians to be more responsible for political decisions. Next year, we will have also the elections for the president, and people want more responsible politicians. And also the hope brings them to that point that they want to work more to develop the country and not to just go in other countries and to move maybe to Germany or somewhere else, because even there, if they go, they see that it's really hard to start a life, of course.
Well, I think it's not often these days that I get to end an interview on a hopeful note, so I think we'll quit while we're ahead. Thank you so much, Vjosa, for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
Vjosa Cecchini is a DW correspondent and independent documentary maker based in Kosovo. And it is indeed on that note that we end the show. This programme was produced by me, Kate Laycock, with help from Laura Kabelka and Charlie Shield. Additional editorial support and guidance was provided by Kira Levine. Our sound engineer was Moritz Vogt. The address for feedback is inside-europe@dw.com. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.